Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Conversations with Cynthia Hyatt, professional psychotherapist and relationship expert. In private practice for over 20 years, Cynthia specializes in teaching individuals, groups, and organizations about how to be successful in relationships, how to handle the variety of differences each gender brings, and ultimately, how to be your own best version. With a dynamic and enthusiastic approach, Cynthia helps each person understand how temperament and gender affects every relationship and inspires her audiences to become all God created them to be. With this understanding, she shares practical tools, resources, and wisdom to guide each person to a transformational understanding of themselves and others. You can find Cynthia on the web at CynthiaHyatt.com and on social media under Cynthia Hyatt Inc. for current events, updates, and inspiration during your week. And now, here's Cynthia.
Well, welcome to Conversations with Cynthia. I'm Cynthia Hyatt, and thank you for joining me today. We have kind of a special show today. This is the fourth show we've done in a series on breast cancer and breast cancer awareness. And at the end of this series, we are really wanting to tackle this issue of pain. And so pain and loss, and this show title is How Do I Make the Pain Stop? The Stages of Grief and Loss. And, you know, one of these problems is that when we've given love to someone and received love from someone and they've died, we are truly in mourning and we're bereft. And to be bereaved literally means to be torn apart. Now, we love and we lose. Death and life are inevitable, and we know this intellectually. But when we lose someone, especially in a way that makes no sense or seems nonsensical, downright mean, unfair, I mean, how do we deal with this pain? And so our question for today's show is, how do I make the pain stop? So I picked a very poignant verse out of the Bible, and it is the 35th verse in the 11th chapter of John. And although it's the shortest verse in the entire Bible, it is by far one of the most poignant and endearing moments in the life of Christ. And these two words say so very much, and they speak so much and tell us so much on so many different levels. And that verse simply says, Jesus wept. So we see in the famous story of Lazarus that this much-beloved man died. And his dying process and subsequent death reveal tremendous grief, loss, bewilderment, anger, and shock, and uncertainty, hurt. I mean, this is only to name a few of the feelings and thoughts experienced by the individuals that we see in this story. This entire community was at a loss. And their faith was shattered. And if they had no faith, then they probably didn't want to have any faith at that point. They might not have even wanted to try. So the loss of something we love, something we become attached to, or something we have hoped for, is such a familiar pain to all humans. Although each of us experiences our own unique version of this pain, no one's pain is alike, even if it's the same circumstance. So we have this famous statement, the only way out is through. And it very succinctly explains this problem of pain that we all have. We would all love to go around the pain, over the pain, even under the pain. But through the pain, I mean, there must be a different way. So we all know of people and have read about different individuals who have not successfully managed the pain of loss. You see, pain demands a response, and regardless of the size or impetus. So we've addressed, you know, in different shows many times, things that might cause pain and the need to manage pain and the purpose of pain. But we are going to really look today about how to deal with pain, how to heal from the pain and grow from the pain, so that the pain of the loss will be gain, because we really want our pain to be gain, to give us gain, not to be in vain. So why is this famous verse, Jesus wept, so powerful? Well, the mere fact that in a literary sense the author has it stand alone tells us that God really wants to make a point. There is really something here for us. Physically, God understands the need for tears and the expression of them. And tear composition varies from tear types. So mainly, tears are composed of water, salts, antibodies, and lysozymes. Those are antibacterial enzymes. But according to a discovery by Dr. William H. Fry II, yes, he's a biochemist from St. Paul Ramsey Medical Center in Minnesota, the composition of tears caused by emotions differs greatly from the tears that are a reaction to irritants, such as onion fumes or dust or allergies. You see, emotional tears are composed of more protein-based hormones, such as prolactin, adrenocorticotropic, and leucine and cephalin, which are natural painkillers. So this is amazing because this suggests that the mechanism behind the experience of crying from emotion is making an individual feel better. See, tears comprised of sorrow actually help us heal. They help us to eventually really feel better because these types of tears release pain as well as release these natural painkillers. So we see this fascinating picture of Jesus, that Jesus wept. He needed to feel better, that those tears gave him strength. Even though crying is so often characterized as, you know, quote-unquote being weak. So we see here this perfect example of Jesus being fully human, operating as a human in a most healthy way, as well as responding appropriately to his friends and his community. So this emotional expression strengthened and helped him do the work that needed to be done. So I want you to also think about, I picked up this other verse that I thought was really fascinating. And you might be familiar with the term weeping and wailing women. Well, this is out of Jeremiah chapter 9, verses 17. And it says, "Look over the trouble we're in and call for help. Send for the singers who can help us mourn our loss. Tell them to hurry, to help us express our loss and lament. Help us get our tears flowing. Make tearful music of our crying. Listen to it. Listen to that torrent of tears out of Zion. We're a ruined people. We're a shamed people. We've been driven from our homes and must leave our land." So what we see here is these people that are in tremendous pain, grief, and loss, and mourning over the fact that they are completely bereft of any land or home any longer. They have nothing. Everything has been taken from them. And so they say, "Send for the singers who can help us mourn our loss. Help us get our tears flowing." And so we see that these women would be called forth because this incident deserves it. It memorializes the significance of that incident. So secondly, it also is necessary as a way to move forward. And thirdly, there's healing physically in crying over the loss. So you may have experienced this phenomenon at funerals when you were moved by the pain of another. And because the first verse in this passage says, "Look over the trouble we're in and call for help. Send for some singers who can help us mourn our loss. Tell them to hurry, to help us express our loss and lament. Help us get our tears flowing." You see, we need to cry, and we need to cry together. And maybe you're like me. I would prefer to cry by myself. And I know that there's nothing wrong with crying by myself. A lot of times that's very helpful, and that's what I need. But I also need to cry with others. And you see, God understands that this world hardens us and that many times we need help to feel the feelings that are appropriate to our situation. And we need to know that the expression of pain is actually healing, and the need to be vulnerable and connected with others strengthens us individually and collectively. It is not about being weak. Vulnerability and weakness are not the same. In fact, the strongest people are the ones that are able to feel the greatest amount of pain. So this statement, think of this statement, "There's no use crying over spilt milk." Well, it sounds logical to our human mind, but it's exceedingly unhealthy when we understand our original design and how humans are made. We even see it in the animal kingdom when they wail and they weep, and they may take even a year to move away from one of their family members. We see this with dolphins and whales and cheetahs and lions and elephants especially, and dogs. I mean, I adopted a dog, and this poor animal was so sad to be gone from their original owner. He sat on my deck for probably about 2 months and just looked out waiting for that owner to come. And she cried and cried and cried. And then she was okay. Then she got to a level of acceptance and realized I was the new owner, and she was okay, and it turned out to be great. But it was painful to see just this poor dog, so sad. So you see, the enemy of our soul wants us to minimize our pain or to deny our pain or avoid our pain, and then to maximize pleasure as a way to thwart the process of achieving a full and rich and abundant life. This enemy of our soul is intent on impeding the process of healing and thereby stealing all that is good from us. So how do we do this? Well, the grief and loss process is a 5-stage model and was first introduced by a Swiss-American psychiatrist, and her name is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she presented this in her book in 1969 on death and dying. So you can see that this process stands the test of time. It was inspired by her work with terminally ill patients. So this idea applies to any type of death that we have to experience. We are talking today about the physical loss of human soul that we have come to know and to love. And so the first stage that we're going to talk about, this is shock and denial. And shock and denial is our psyche's ability to slow down the process of accepting a loss. So shock is just, you know, sometimes you see people go into shock, they might faint, they might dissociate, they might just start screaming and yelling, no, 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 no. Then they might just become somewhat, they could become catatonic. There's all kinds of things that people do in shock. And then the denial piece of shock and denial is just this ongoing feeling of this can't be true, it's not possible. I can't believe it, I just saw them. Or in the case of cancer patients, they were doing so well, they were making it, they were recovering. And so this denial piece is similar if you look at it as taking in a huge thing that you have to assimilate. It's larger than life. It's similar to, if we make it a metaphor of eating, that a minor loss in your day-to-day living might be, you know, taking a bite out of a Pop-Tart and chewing it, swallowing it, and it's over. That's like maybe missing the light that caused you to be late at work, that loss of time. Versus the loss of a loved one that you fought with and held and talked to and cried with and got to know deeply and intimately. That's similar to the metaphor of consuming, needing to consume the entire aisle of cereal at Safeway, which would take, after bite, after bite, after bite, years possibly to consume all of that. So, as always, you know, we go through the shock and denial, and then the second stage we call bargaining. And bargaining is this time that we just continue to do the shoulda, coulda, wouldas, if only then. So we say, oh, I should have done this, I could have done that. If I would have done this, then that wouldn't have happened. Or why didn't they do this? We talked to them about doing this. Why didn't they do that? And that's a tough stage because we as Americans are very action-oriented and we don't like to accept things that don't work for us. And so we can get very stuck in bargaining. Now, the third stage is anger. And anger is a very legitimate feeling for any type of loss. It is the natural way that humans feel. We are never to condemn ourselves. We are never to judge ourselves. We are never to be angry about being angry at ourselves. Because anger is a very powerful, powerful feeling, and it's very legitimate when you lose something of great value. The problem with anger is that it oftentimes is very tempting for us to stay stuck there. Because anger is very empowering, and it can kind of serve sometimes as a wall or a block to feeling mourning and sadness. It's a great way for me to not have to maybe intimately connect with other people's pain. If I just stay angry, I kind of brace myself against the loss. And so anger is one of those things where while we want to accept it and understand it and need to feel it, we need to make sure that we are working through it. Because the stage four is sadness and mourning. This is one of the most difficult stages to feel because it is inactive. So out of all the feeling realms, we have sad, mad, glad, and scared. The sad realm of feelings, which is upset and hurt and sadness and grief and weepiness, those feelings are very inactive. So many times we find ourselves, when we start to get sad, that we'd rather be angry, or we'd start going back into bargaining. So we come to the last stage, which is that of acceptance and forgiveness. And acceptance is usually characterized by a feeling of contentment, not necessarily happiness at all, but a feeling like it's okay now, like I'm okay now. I've resolved it. It's settled within me. I understand it as best as I can. Acceptance does not have any of the lack of forgiveness, the anger toward the person or toward other caregivers or toward family members that they should have acted in a certain way or done certain things. You know, many times when we have terminally ill patients, there's a possibility of suicide, and we get past being angry about their suicide. So this last stage is difficult to get to, and what you'll find in these five stages is that you're going to cycle through them, and you may skip one and go back to another one and come back to it at another time. And so you may get to the level of acceptance and then find out that, wow, I thought I had accepted this. I thought I was okay. And then I had to do Christmas without that person. And I found out I'm not okay. Or maybe I found out more information, and now I'm upset again. So you just have to know that acceptance, this is one of these things that we constantly work through. And when it's a major loss, it's going to probably take anywhere from 1 to 5 years if we're really committed to doing this process and not introducing maladaptive coping skills as a way to avoid the whole grief and loss process. So there are some things that might be present in my life that may, quote-unquote, get in the way of me going through the grief and loss process. And some of that is a lack of positive coping skills. Some of it might be the inability to manage stress well. I might have a tendency to rely on defense mechanisms, which are things like possibly addictions or dissociation or displacement or passive-aggressiveness or manipulation, intellectualizing. There's a myriad of these. And one of the things that gets in the way of my healing is actively resisting the grief and loss process, or a general fear of the pain of going through that process, the general fear of pain itself. So what we want to make sure is that we are not ever judging ourselves. And we are not ever judging, we are not ever judging others as they are going through this process. And that we are not putting time constraints on ourselves, but that we are recognizing that the greater the loss, the longer the time it takes to assimilate that entire loss of all that it entails. So this is a cycle. It's not a rigid, sequential process. You don't check it off your list. You really have to be fluid and flexible as you experience it and really begin to understand yourself. So we have these stages. And I wanted to read a poem to you that was very poignant to me. And I've had much loss in my life, as really everybody has. And so I'm very well acquainted with the stages of grief and loss. And the fourth stage, which is the sadness and mourning, I came across this poem that was very, very, very helpful to me and very comforting to me. And it says, "I walked a mile with pleasure. She chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and ne'er a word said she. But oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me." And that was done by Robert Browning Hamilton. And I just love that poem because I just think to myself, I did. I learned great things in my sorrow. Not things that I ever necessarily originally wanted to learn, but things I'm very grateful for. And so what are some other things that might be roadblocks to effectively managing our pain? Well, a person may not recognize the change has taken place. And so this could be something like, I didn't recognize that, you know, my friend who's battling cancer, when she took a turn for the worse, it was really for the worse. I just really thought we were going around the mountain again and we would get it, we'd get over it, we'd get past it like we have every other battle. It might be that I might not expect to mourn the loss in the way that I'm doing it. It may be hitting me harder than I ever anticipated. I might not recognize that there were other things that I might have to mourn as well. Not just a person dying, but maybe the everyday structure. If I was the primary caregiver, I might be having to mourn the loss of that life I had, that every day I went and we did these certain things and I took care of her and we talked about these things. And so there may be other things that are associated with the death of this person that I wasn't aware of. There may be some feelings like anger and rejection or guilt or shame or that complicate, you know, and obscure the underlying grief. Or there may be some social stigmatism that goes with it, especially if the person succumbed to suicide. And so it may be that friends and family are dealing with it differently than I am, and I'm not feeling like it's safe for me to talk about what's going on with me. And so there may be some other blocks that are in the way, because maybe I haven't grieved the loss of somebody previous that I know has passed, and now I've got this person that's already passed, and I haven't even finished the other person. Or maybe I didn't realize how angry I was at the way this person's parents reacted to their cancer. Maybe I wasn't aware of how angry I was at the husband because maybe he couldn't take it and he left her. So there's many other things that can get in the way. Maybe that I don't want to upset or add to the grief of other people, so I try to keep it all in so I don't make anybody else feel worse. So there's a lot of different things. I want you to take some time and think about what might be things that are getting in the way of me really overcoming this and feeling and getting through this grief and loss process. And so we have to understand that forgiveness is oftentimes a big part of the acceptance, because we may have to forgive whomever or whatever created or supported the loss. Now, oftentimes it's a person, and maybe they betrayed us, maybe they rejected us, maybe they thwarted the success, maybe they stole from us, maybe they abused us, and in that process, maybe they died. And so we also have to understand that sometimes it might be our body. Maybe we feel betrayed by our body. Maybe our body let us down, or we feel like it worked against us. Maybe it's just ourselves. Maybe we messed up or we failed. We're having a hard time forgiving ourselves because the day that person really needed me, maybe I was too exhausted and tired and I couldn't get out of bed myself and be there. And so there might be some things that I've done that I can't get over. And maybe I need to forgive God. And I know this sounds strange to have to forgive God, but I've had many talks with my own patients as well as myself about the concept that I kind of hurt my feelings on God. Because, you know, we know that God is perfect, or we would like to believe that, and that he has our best interests in mind. But we sure don't feel like it. And so it can very much complicate our faith. And many times we have to forgive God because my feelings got hurt by him, because he didn't do it the way I wanted him to do it. So he didn't do it my way, and now I'm despondent. And I've had to tell patients several times, you know, the same way that maybe you have to forgive God is similar to maybe as a clinician, you've had to forgive me. Even if I did the right thing therapeutically, maybe it still hurt your feelings. And so it's this idea of forgiveness is about how I'm feeling, and it's an impediment to me being close to whoever that other person is. Now, sometimes there are people that we forgive and we still are not going to be in relationship with them because they're not safe. So I want you to think about this idea of bereavement, that bereavement is what I have lost and grief is how I feel about it or my reaction to it. So I'm going to take a couple of moments here and go through some what we would call the mourner's six reconciliation needs. And this was done by a Dr. Alan Wolfelt, and I really like the work that he has done. And he talks about how the death of someone we love, how it changes our life forever. And there's a moment from the before to the after, and it's a very long and painful journey. And we have to heal, and we cannot skirt the outside edges of grief. Instead, we must journey through it. And sometimes meandering the side road, sometimes plowing directly into the raw center of grief. And so there are six things that I like the way he did this that help us. And these are some basic human needs in order to heal. And the number one thing is I have to acknowledge the reality of the death. And that's a really difficult one. That's shock and denial stage, that bargaining and anger. That's the, I don't want to go through the grief and loss process, but I really need to acknowledge the reality of it. And the second one is embracing the pain of the loss. So this need of mourning requires us to embrace the pain of the loss, even if we don't want to. And you might have to take it in little doses, like we talked about, you know, one bite at a time. And the third one is remembering the person who died. And so do you have any kind of relationship with the person when they die? Of course. Of course we have relationship with them even after they're gone, because we have memory. We have relationship memory. And so those precious memories and the things that are left, such as photos and souvenirs, these are examples of some of the things that give testimony to a different form of a continued relationship. So this needs to be part of the mourning process, that we have evidence of this person that even though the person is gone, we have evidence that the person was here. And we still have that relationship in our memory, even though it's not as tangible as we would like it to be. We need to also develop a new self-identity, because part of the self-identity comes from the relationship that you have with other people. And so when someone with whom you have a relationship dies, well, your identity or the way you see yourself naturally changes. So maybe you went from being a wife or husband to a widow or a widower. Maybe you went from being a caregiver to who am I now? What do I do? What's my role now? So it means that we have to take on new roles, and we have to figure out how those can be filled by the person who died. That those things, that those roles that we had, we have to find a different way to fill them. And we have to change roles. And it can be very painful, because some of that process means that, well, if I've moved on, I've moved away from that person. I have less of that person. When really what we want to remind ourselves is the greatest gift we can give that person is to have a life that looks positive, because that person affected our life in a positive manner, even if it was painful. So we know that anyone that has passed would not ever want to think that their fight, their battle left us stuck, angry, upset, and living a life that was one of loss and bereavement and utter grief. Instead, they would rather think that, wow, my life meant something. And because my life meant something to you, you're a better person for it. And so sometimes me being a better person for the pain doesn't mean that I'm glad they're gone because I'm a better person. It means that their death, their passing, their battle caused me to find out things about myself I might not have ever known. Like maybe my own stability. I didn't know I was that stable. Maybe I didn't know I could be that compassionate. Maybe I didn't know I had that kind of endurance. Maybe I didn't know I was that intelligent to figure out a whole bunch of the stuff the doctors were talking to me about. Maybe I didn't know I could love that deeply. Maybe I didn't know I could feel that deeply. So what you want to ask yourself, what are the things that caused me to be me, that this person's life have helped me to find? And so we also need to do search for meaning. Because when someone you love dies, you naturally question the meaning and the purpose of life. And then we want to make sure that we're doing ongoing support from others. Like we said earlier in this show, that we can't mourn all alone. And we reconcile our grief. So I want to leave you with a very poignant statement by Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She says, the reality is that you will grieve forever. You will not get over the loss of a loved one. You will learn to live with it. You will heal, and you will rebuild yourself around the loss you have suffered. You will be whole again, but you will never be the same, nor should you be the same, nor would you want to. So I leave you with that quote, and I love the work that Dr. Kubler-Ross has done. And I want to encourage you in the process that you are going through, and that there is life after the death of a loved one, and that loved one can be very proud of the process that you're doing now. Have a great week. Do the best you can, and I look forward to talking with you next week.